The torch has been passed. Now it is up to all of us to fight for the America we believe in. America's ready for a new chapter. America's ready for a better story. And Kamala Harris is ready for the job.
No, she isn't. Welcome, everybody. The Commute with Carlson, Talk Radio 570 KVI. So great hearing everybody out there. Good to see you, radio legend Mark Christopher, Philip J. Vandervoort III.
Nice to have back. I was thinking a rain got to you. Put a little sniffle in the nose, couldn't talk, had to stay home maybe.
Just had a pounding headache for a while, and it has passed. I shouldn't. I attribute it to watching the Democratic National Convention on TV.
There you go. Know?
So anyway,
we're staying home, right?
But I have to do it because if I do it, if I undergo the supreme sacrifice of watching the Democratic National Convention, then our listeners don't have to. I could just cover the lowlights for them, and there's several, and we'll get into it here on the Commute with Carlson. But I got to tell you, I really liked Donald Trump's reaction while he was campaigning. He was responding to the first night of the Democratic convention.
I watched last night in amazement as they tried to pretend that everything was great, the crime was great, the border was great, there wasn't a problem at all, no inflation, no nothing.
And if there is inflation, well, don't blame them. It's big business. They're gouging people. Thank goodness we are there to protect people. Anyway, which is, you know, you expect a little hyperbole at the convention. I love Barack Obama quoting John F. Kennedy. The torch is passed to a new generation. While they are trying to throw Bobby Kennedy Jr. off the ballot in as many states as possible. So I guess when you're the party that's out to save democracy, it can get a little inconvenient if some people vote for someone like Bobby Kennedy Jr., so you've got to try and get him off the ballot. Anyway, how are you all doing? Go ahead, text me. Tell me what you're thinking about the convention at 206-421-5757. That is 206-421-5757. The John Carlson Show, coming to you every single day of the work week from 6 till 9 a.m. And you know what we do on Wednesday, every Wednesday, our world famous kind of legendary lyric contest now underway. Here's how it works. I read you a lyric from a classic hit, famous song from the past, and when you hear us play that lyric going in or out of commercial break, be the 10th caller, 206-421-5757. That's 206-421-5757. And you win some nice prizes. Isn't that correct, radio legend?
Tell you, man. Carlson Commute, they love us at Daniel's Broiler. We always have to throw in the gift certificate here, the steak dinner, the prime chicken, and the specialties there with the seafood, four locations. I just say go to the website, see what it's all about at danielsbroiler.com. More concert tickets. Boy, can you pick a favorite for this band? We've got two tickets for these guys.
Oh, the Doobies.
Pick a song, any song. All are on the song list, by the way. Okay, so you need to know they're going to be at the White River Amphitheater, John, Friday, September 6th. Now, they've been doing this tour. In June, there was a little mess up here with schedules or whatever. They had to reschedule White River. They were going to start their tour there, but they're coming here. September 6th, Friday. Touring with them, the Robert Cray Band and or cool. Steve Winwood. I'm getting confirmation. Looks like Robert Cray Band's going to be with them. You need to know Tommy Johnston, still with the band, okay? We have Pat Simmons, Michael McDonald, who came in at 75 when Johnston fell ill and they needed a vocalist. Yep. And then John McPhee. And all the songs they're going to play, and of course they've been doing a lot with their song Lahaina to raise funds for everybody there with the fires. But it's going to be a great night. My daughters are going and saying, Dad, we have an extra ticket. I said, okay, I'll go with you.
Oh, yeah.
VIP seats too, John. I've never had the VIP.
I saw the Doobies. Ooh. Back in the 80s, playing with Carl Wilson. He was the other side of the ticket.
Yeah.
You know, Carl Wilson from the Beach Boys.
Mm-hmm.
And, geez, that was a while ago. I guess they may have changed a bit.
Yeah. But they still have the sound. And, again, just the compliments of, you know, seeing Michael McDonald, because he's been doing a lot of his own. But a lot of people remember 80s Doobies, like perhaps you do, of that sound.
Yeah.
When he was with Steely Dan before that. But, again, uh-huh. Tom Johnston got ill. They said, we need help. Michael said, I'll fill in. And
that's
to have
cool.
them both there, this is going to be good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I've always been a fan of Robert Cray.
Yeah.
Always been a fan of his. And he's out of Pierce County, if I'm not mistaken. Mm. Isn't that where he began his career?
Yeah, just so many connections.
Yeah, I know he's got a local Northwest connection, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
He was in the movie Animal House. Did you know this?
That's right.
Robert Cray was one of the backing band members for Otis Day and the Knights.
Oh,
so
I
he
did
was,
not know that.
He was one of the guys on stage okay. as the Knights in Animal House.
He was pretty, a knight.
Pretty cool move.
Very
right?
nice.
Yeah. So White River Amphitheater, September 6th. That's a Friday night. Two tickets. I'll look for you. You look for me. Maybe they'll throw me on stage and say, well, you're here, Mark. Why don't you MC? You never know.
You've done that before.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so we forgot, like to know your lyric. This is from a hit song in the 1970s. Here we go. I'm not a present for your friends to open. This boy's too young to be singing the blues. I'm not a present for your friends to open. This boy's too young to be singing the blues. Where have you heard that song?
And one clue we can say, it's not a Doobie Brothers hit.
It is. No, no. Some,
okay.
See, some people would think that I would pick a Doobie Brothers hit.
Right.
But no, I'm not going to make it easy for you. That's your lyric for today. All right, 10 minutes after 6. Did you guys watch Joe Biden's speech?
I did. I ended up watching maybe the last 25 minutes, half hour.
Highlights.
I was
I
a little unclear,
bed.
Yeah,
too
as to how long it went on.
First of all, here's an open question that people are debating. As you know, Joe Biden didn't get on until about 11 o'clock p.m.
Yes, Eastern.
On Eastern time.
Yeah, a lot of chatter about
which
that.
Which is... you know, a work day, right? The following day is a work day. And he didn't finish until after midnight. So a lot of people are wondering, did the powers that be deliberately push the program so that he would not get on prime time? I vote yes. For instance, there is no way that Barack Obama, who was on last night, there was no way he was going to be speaking after midnight or in the wee hours. They're going to put him up, you know, center stage. And, of course, flowery nice things to say about Joe, his close friend, his brother. He said, my brother. Anyway, here's the bottom line. They're being as nice as they can to Joe Biden to paper over the fact that basically he was kicked off the stage. And it's interesting. We've been talking for weeks about how it was very clear that he was pressured out. Shown the door, kicked off stage, etc. It wasn't until Maureen Dowd of the New York Times wrote a column on Sunday that said a coup is still a coup, that it became openly discussed among the, if you will, the liberal intelligentsia, the media, the commentators, consultants, etc., etc. Of course. And it showed in his speech. His speech, you know, we were talking, you know, would it go, you know, is it just going to be a very cheerful. Thank you very much. I'm all for Kamala, you know, 10, 15 minutes. No, it was an hour long. It was angry. Have you noticed how Joe Biden's mouth kind of curls into a sneer so much more than it used to?
Yeah.
Anyway.
A lot of characterizations of angry guy speech from Monday night Joe Biden.
Yeah. It was angry. It was petulant. And I think that basically he's channeling the anger he feels toward his own party into attacking Donald Trump. He told several things he said about Trump were just lies. But anyway, we got some of them here. It was a lie he repeated from his State of the Union speech, which was called out even then for being a lie. This is about, and there were several. Here's just the first one. We don't have time to go over all of them. Is connected to the percentage of taxes that billionaires pay on capital gains. Here's what he said in Chicago on Monday night.
You know, we have a thousand billionaires in America.
You're going to have to deal with the stumbling and bumbling. It's just, you know.
It happens.
You know what their average tax rate they pay? 8.2%. If we just increase our taxes, we proposed to 25%, which isn't the highest tax rate even, it would raise $500 billion new dollars over 10 years.
Okay. He was fact-checked on this claim when he said it the first time in the State of the Union. This comes from King TV.
President Joe Biden has repeatedly called on Congress to enact a minimum tax rate of 25% for billionaires, claiming it would raise $500 billion over the next 10 years. During the State of the Union address on March 7th, he claimed what they're actually paying is much lower.
You know what the average federal tax is for those billionaires? 8.2%.
But is that true? Using these sources, Verify dug into the data to find out whether this figure is accurate. According to the most recent IRS data on the top 400 wealthiest taxpayers, Biden's claim is false. They actually pay an average federal income tax rate of about 23%. So where does the 8.2% number come from? Everyone pays income tax based on how much money they earn. But the White House and experts with the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center say that's not the calculation Biden was using. Instead, the 8.2% is an estimate generated by White House economists that takes into account money that is generally not considered taxable, like the increased value in unsold stocks or unrealized gains. Here's how Vanguard explains it. If you bought a share for $10 and it's now worth $12, you have an unrealized gain of $2. Under the current U.S. tax system, that extra $2 isn't considered taxable income until you sell the share. But under the White House's analysis, it is.
Oh, well, under their estimate, it ought to be.
Unrealized gains.
So in other words, you should be taxed on money that you don't actually have.
Well, and
until you sell the share, you don't have that extra $2.
Yeah, and for Biden, it's just the way to completely distort the picture.
Well, there's a word for that. The word is lie.
Yeah.
The word is lie. Should we really be surprised? Here he is in June of 2023.
Now they tell me it's about 1,000 because of the last administration. Well, guess what? You know what percentage they pay in taxes? 8%. EIGHT.
Again, the guy constantly lies. This has been pointed out over and over again. And he just keeps saying it. He did the same thing about Charlottesville. Just keeps repeating a lie that has been debunked time and time again.
Yeah, debunked by the Washington Post.
And if he's
debunked by Snopes.
Yeah, if he's, you know, too far gone to realize it, the people around him, they know it, and they just keep putting it in the prompter anyway. It just shows you how down low and dirty these people are. Again, no integrity, no respect for people's intelligence, no respect for the truth. They just keep repeating the lie about Charlottesville. They keep repeating the lie about 8%, because if they get called out on it, well, some people will catch on, but other people won't. So this is what happens when you are really cynical about the truth.
What was a Charlottesville lie? Just to catch up here for some listeners.
The both sides characterization, yeah, the characterization was distorted.
That Donald Trump was saying that there were both sides, the rioters and the people who opposed the riot, had people who were good people on both sides. It was a lie. What Trump was referring to was there had been a demonstration earlier in the park in Charlottesville where there was a statue of, I think, Robert E. Lee at one end and Stonewall Jackson at the other. And there were protests saying they should take down those statues. And there was a counter demonstration saying, no, they're part of the park's tradition. They're part of the park's history. They should be left right where they are. He said, well, there's good people on both sides. So, and this has now become like, this has been corrected so many times, and Biden went right out and repeated it again on Monday. Again, there's nothing left in the barrel for him. And he so despises Donald Trump that he just will say, and he always has said whatever he thought would benefit him. You know, he said that his son, Beau, was killed serving overseas. No, he wasn't. He unfortunately contracted brain cancer after his service and died here in the States.
Yeah, and the connection seems to be that the Biden family says that it's connected to burn pits that were used while he was deployed in Iraq.
Yeah. Again, no truth to it. Nothing. You know, he even once, you know, he tragically, right after he was elected to the U.S. Senate, before he took the oath of office, his wife and one of his sons was killed in a tragic car accident. And Biden, when giving speeches, would sometimes say she was killed by a drunk behind the wheel of a truck. It's completely false. I mean, completely false. It was a tragic accident. It was actually Mrs. Biden's fault. And the truck that she hit was doing nothing wrong. The driver was completely sober. But he just says this stuff. And it's so annoying. It's regrettable that Trump can't dust him off for good. But the fact that the Democrats, you know, are ixnaying him says plenty about how desperate they are to cling to power. Well, more on all that ahead. But first, we've got Philip J. Vandervoort III with the social media sweep. It is 22 minutes after 6 o'clock. Good morning.
Every day, and I'll send all my loving to you. All my loving I will send to you. All my loving.
It was 60 years ago today the Beatles played Seattle.
Can you imagine real quick here where we're at, Lower Queen Anne, our new studios at KVI, two blocks from Climate Pledge, if this was 1964, John, we'd be this close to the Coliseum where the Beatles
yes.
played.
And George Harrison would say, what's a Climate Pledge? What's that?
Fun stories and ideas and sharing later on this morning on this, too.
All right. Philip J. Vandervoort III, what's going on in the social media world?
Well, let's go to the Washington Public Lands Commissioner primary results. The latest, the lead is, or the lead, I guess, it's the second and third place race, really. is down to 51 votes now. The social media sweep sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort. Dave Up the Grove is currently in second place with 396,300 votes.
Wow.
51 votes behind in third place is Sue Kuhl. Kuhl?
Kuhl.
Kuhl. Kuhl Peterson.
Sue Kuhl Peterson.
And this is, it looks like, going to a hand recount. There's got to be, I mean, just amongst the top three finishers, there's over 1.2 million ballots that have been cast. And then there's maybe even Kevin Van De Weg in Wedge or Weg for that state lawmaker.
Port Angeles.
He's got 140,000 votes. So there's another probably 500,000 votes. So you could be closing in on almost 2 million votes. Mm-hmm. And they are separated by 51 votes.
This
so
is the
if you did not vote in the primary and you tend to vote conservative, if there are 51 KVI listeners out there that went, eh, you know, I forgot to vote, I didn't vote.
Oh, I guarantee.
You potentially could have put a Republican over the top of a Democrat and then had two Republicans advance to a statewide race for office.
Yeah, no, it completely changes the chemistry of that race. If there's two Republicans, then you're going to have fundamentally a conservative approach, you know, to land stewardship, public lands. If it's Dave Up the Grove, it's a liberal urban environmentalist.
It's a Constantine-esque Democrat that is going to be in the final. All right.
So and all the votes, you know, of course, have been counted. So, again, 51 votes. This is even closer than the Dino Rossi, Christine Gregoire governor's race of 2004.
However, there would have been way more ballots cast for that one. But you're right. Percentage-wise, this one is going to be much tighter, much closer. And then this is the other thing that makes me nervous for what happens with this hand recount is they're magically going to be, we erred, and the error goes in favor of the Democratic Party candidate. So we'll have to see which direction this ultimately goes once they go through the hand recounting process to hopefully be more accurate.
All right. That's Philip J. Vandervoort III giving us the latest update. And again, congratulations, Sue Kuhl Peterson, who, again, is 51 votes away in that race, was outspent more than 20-1. That's 95% to 5. Okay. She was outspent 20-1. And is on the verge of maybe getting a victory. 51 votes down with nearly 2 million votes cast. 7 o'clock. That's not our legendary lyric. That's one of the Beatles' early hits. They played it that night.
One of 12 of the playlist. I'm playing them all here through the morning.
12. They only sang 12 songs?
Half-hour concert, 12 songs.
They played for 30 minutes?
All
that was their
coming,
concert?
We're going to get you new content of what happened on this day 60 years ago, John. What do you hear it?
Anyway, the Beatles playing what was then the Seattle Center Coliseum, and then it was a different place. Then now it's Climate Panic Arena, Climate Pledge Arena. Okay, here we go. Here is your legendary lyric for today. When you hear it going in or out of commercial break, be the 10th caller. Some nice prizes coming your way. I'm not a present for your friends to open. This boy's too young to be singing the blues. Not a present for your friends to open. This boy's too young to be singing the blues. It's not the Beatles. So, you know, do let us know when you hear it. Be caller number 10. Some nice prizes coming your way. All right, right now we have young Zach coming your way on the John Carlson Show. Our Chicago correspondent at the Democratic National Convention, courtesy of our friends at All Red Heating and Cooling. Good morning, Zach.
Good morning, John. How's it going back in Seattle?
Well, it's going fine here. Tell us what you are seeing on the streets of Chicago, and what are you seeing in the convention hall? Let's start with what it's like out on the streets of Chi-Town.
Well, I'm not really out on the streets. It's kind of hard to get there. We're inside a couple different perimeters, and certainly perimeters that have been reinforced now that one was breached just the other day. So I don't get to see much of what's going on the streets. I can watch it from the television sets here in the arena and what plays out on social media, courtesy of Jonathan Cho at times. But from in the arena, we certainly have a different atmosphere than I think the nation is seeing out on the streets.
Interesting. Okay. Now, we're hearing that there are not just several hundred, but tens of thousands of, quote, pro-Palestinian protesters. Are you in any position to see them at all?
I am not. Like I said, we're deep inside the perimeter, and the protesters are being kept a very safe distance away from any of the dignitaries, any of the delegates. But as we discussed in your absence yesterday, John, there's a couple pro-Palestinian sort of demonstrators within the delegations, some of which within the Washington State delegation itself. I interviewed a couple younger delegates from Washington State, and we ran that audio yesterday. They are uncommitted delegates, or as they call themselves, ceasefire delegates, and are trying to, quote, kind of spread that movement across the states. I think Phil's got a piece of audio, which is a delegate from Kentucky, an older gentleman who I noticed wearing a keffiyeh the other day, and I had to ask him a few questions, and he has a hot take, as the kids would say, about a Israel state.
This is a delegate wearing a keffiyeh, which are really not very fashionable in the state of Kentucky.
I believe that the Book of Jeremiah speaks about not a Zionist state, but a return to love and hope, that if you read the book of Jeremiah, there is no support for a simply Jewish state.
Well, first of all, I've read the book of Jeremiah, and a lot of it has to do with the Jews being driven off and pulled out of what is now Israel in three phases by the Babylonians, led by King Nebuchadnezzar. So I'm not sure what this guy's point is. And he's talking about love and compassion. Those are not two words that I associate with Hamas.
No, generally not. And what was interesting was just a few steps down on the floor. See, what we have discussed all week long here is that the floor is much larger than the RNC. It's not just the literal floor of the convention center, or the arena, rather. It goes up into kind of the whole 100-section ring all around, mm-hmm. where the Washington State delegation and the Kentucky delegation right behind us is. So I walked just a few steps down, and there's delegates holding signs that say something to the effect of Democrats for Israel. So there seems to be a real issue, and even within the convention, that's not really being addressed on stage. It's not being talked about by many, and then certainly the demonstrations outside are something that many of these dignitaries and speakers are conveniently choosing to ignore. I spoke with Rob Reiner, of all people, yesterday. I think we have audio we'll play a little later in the show, but I asked him about the demonstrations. I said, what do the Democrats need to do on stage for the nation to see some sort of show of unity from the podium to address what's going on outside? Because certainly maybe the delegates don't see what's going on in the streets, but we all know those watching at home do. And Rob Reiner seemed to imply that he believed the protests were conservatives, and I didn't have the heart to tell him that he might need to go take a second look on his way in the door.
Yeah.
But there seems to be a real disconnect and a real issue that's not being addressed here.
Now, can you leave the perimeter and then come back in, or is it a real headache to do that?
Yesterday we left to go get lunch, and took us a little over half hour just to get back through the gate. So it is really difficult to get out and get back in, especially I believe they had to temporarily suspend some access on Monday after that perimeter got breached. So it's certainly not worth risking not being able to get back in to go poke around in the streets.
Okay. Tell me what, because now we've had, you know, two nights of convention action. How would you compare the conventions of the first two nights for the Democrats versus what you saw in Milwaukee with the Republicans?
One of the biggest differences I'm noticing, especially from the podium, is that if you recall in Milwaukee, very few of the Republicans referenced Joe Biden, the previous administration. There was certainly a large focus on a call for unity within the party and highlighting the Republican platform. That is missing here in Chicago. It is all Trump all the time. It kind of feels like Trump has a second convention, to be honest with you. He's the subject of every speech, certainly was of former President Obama's last night, Michelle Obama's, Hillary Clinton's speech, obviously. It was constant Trump bashing all the time. They had his former press secretary from Wenatchee, I believe it is. Stephanie Grisham came out yesterday and spoke out against Trump. So Trump is the main topic here, which I felt was missing in Milwaukee. It was not a let's bash Biden festival. It was a let's band together and here's what we can do for you. There was, if you recall, all those highlights of everyday Americans kind of in between each dignitary keynote.
No,
and that's once again missing here in Chicago.
So basically the mood of the Republicans, again, this was right after the attempt on President Trump's life. So the mood around the Republicans was, let's all unite. Let's all band together and move forward. And the Democrats are uniting around Kamala by and breaching any tension over Joe Biden by attacking Donald Trump ceaselessly.
Yeah, and I think the Democrats are really missing the opportunity that Republicans were able to take advantage of. You have primetime TV. You have the chance to show the nation what you can do for them and why to vote for that party. And the Democrats are choosing to treat it like an echo chamber and just rally the troops inside this arena. And I think that's going to be a big misstep.
That is a very astute observation by Zach. Again, that when you're a nationally televised convention, you're really getting free advertising time to show the nation at large what you'd like to do.
And if the best pitch you have is we're better than him, I don't know if that's going to win it. And I don't know if that's true. I talked to Byron Donalds yesterday, which was someone I was not expecting to see here at the
Democratic Congressman?
National Congressman Byron Donalds, not someone I expected to see
Black
here
Republican
in Chicago at the
Democratic Florida, I believe.
Exactly, correct. And I was speaking with him, and I said, kind of half jokingly, I said, you know, I came in as a Republican, but I said I'm a young man. I'll keep an open mind and listen to what ideas and policies are going to be shared from the stage, and we'll see what they have to offer. And I said, did I miss something? Because I didn't hear a lot of a plan. I didn't hear many policies. I didn't hear much of what they can do for me. And I think we have the audio we'll play later in the show potentially for that as well. But
next hour we're going to play.
Perfect. He concurred with that observation that they're not taking that opportunity to share what their plan is. Have seen the headlines?
No, they're
going to
be
the
very
platform,
light on details. What a great point. They're going to be very light on details because details don't help them.
Speaking of details, when they released the platform, they couldn't even be bothered to swap out President Biden's name with Vice President Harris's name.
Yeah.
I believe it still referenced the number one thing they could do is reelect President Biden. So clearly that's the attention to detail that they have when it comes to policy and their platform.
That is in their draft platform that, again, not from 2 weeks or 2 months ago. This is what they have in Chicago, and it talks about Joe Biden's second term. But the bottom line on this is two very different moods, and, yeah, they're in attack mode. I think they recognize something that I've been saying now for quite some time, which is they can't win this election.
I got a little bit of breaking news here.
But Trump can lose it.
A little bit of breaking news here from Chicago, actually on Como 4 of all places. We just had KNWN reporter Jeff Poggiola doing a live hit on Como 4, and they had their pulse poll that they do every day pop up on the screen, and it said, has your opinion changed here watching the DNC on TV? And it said 39% of who, I don't know how many people have voted so far, but 39% have said they've changed their vote to GOP. That's what the Como 4 poll says.
How many have changed their vote the other way?
7.
7% are more likely to vote Democrat. 39% are more likely to vote Republican?
Yes, yes. That's the, you know, viewer poll that they do every day on different topics.
Right.
So these are Seattle voters.
Very unscientific.
Seattle voters that are watching
Puget Sound.
Puget Sound. Watching this play out on TV, and it's 30 of, like I said, I don't know how many people have voted so far, but 39% of those who voted on Como 4 have said they have now changed their mind to vote for the GOP.
Well, we'll see if that's reflected in the national polls.
They have two more nights to skew that number a little further.
All right. We'll talk with you again next hour. Again, that's our man with the eyes inside the Democratic National Convention, Young Zach, here on Talk Radio 570 KVI, brought to you by our friends at All Red Heating and Cooling. Our good buddy Lars Larson, right around the corner on the morning commute. Good. And back we are, the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI, joined by our good buddy Lars Larson, our noon to three host. Good morning, Lars. How are you?
I'm doing well, John. And the audience last night in Chicago seemed to really appreciate the visual penis joke from Barack Hussein Obama.
For our listeners who did not have to watch the show, presentation, because I told them, don't worry, I'll watch it for you. Go ahead and paint the picture.
Well, here's Barack Obama, and he's going off, and he and his wife are a pair, because she's saying, you know, my parents distrusted people who took more than they needed, says the woman whose estimated net worth is at least in the tens of millions. It may be as high as $150 million, owns three houses, one of which cost or is worth about $27 million today. And her parents probably would have distrusted her. But then Barry gets up there, you know, the big constitutional scholar, and he's going off on Trump. Trump got mentioned literally hundreds of times yesterday. Joe Biden barely merited a mention. And he says, and he holds his hands about a foot and a half apart and says, Trump's got to stop focusing on the size of his crowd. So he was keeping it clean that way. And he moves his hands about, you know, 5 inches apart and then looks up. It's very clear that he was telling a penis joke.
Keep it classy.
Keep it classy, Barry.
Barack Obama. We're going to play some audio from Michelle Obama.
That woman hates
right
America,
up.
You know.
Well, I just think she's got a chip on her shoulder, and
yep.
She has since she was in college. She just seems to me to be a very angry person. She's always struck me
and angry. You know, my favorite quote from her.
And you've got to ask yourself, why?
Yeah, why? She's got everything that America could ever promise to somebody: great education, high position, millions of dollars, nice house, and she hates the country.
Can I ask you one quick question, Mr. Reiner?
Yeah, sure.
What do the Democrats have to do to turn it up to 11 tonight?
We've already turned it up to 11.
Well, that was young Zach talking to Rob Reiner, i.e. Meathead from All in the Family, Marty DeBerge from This is Spinal Tap, one of my favorite all-time movies. That was a great question from Zach. What do they need to do to turn... That was the movie, Spinal Tap, where...
Did anyone else think to ask Rob Reiner that question at the Democratic National Convention at the United Center in Chicago? Only young Zach thought
Only
of it.
Only young Zach. That's very good. Well,
I just listened to Zach's interview with Byron Donalds, the Florida Republican congressman. It's 4 or 5 minutes long. It's fantastic. So Byron Donalds is there on the scene inside the Democratic National Convention as a Republican. And he's got some great responses to things that the Democrats are trying to say and talk about.
And I like that. I like that, you know, there were plenty of Democrats, prominent Democrats, who were at the Republican convention as, you know, just to say, hey, here's the other side of the story. And that makes conventions a little more fun. Mm-hmm. And so it's good to see that there's also some Republicans at the Democratic convention. Yeah. So...
Enjoy the point counterpoint.
We'll be hearing more from young Zach a little later on the commute. I mentioned Michelle Obama. She spoke last night before Barack. And in some ways, she was the more interesting, because you might recall when she was making the case for Hillary Clinton, she said, when they go low, we go high. Well, the Democrats aren't going too high right now. It's basically a fake love fest for Joe Biden. Okay, everyone's relieved that he's off the ballot. And it is a everybody circle the wagons and get behind Camilla and say how great she's always been, and we've just never noticed until now. And then they get to the one truly unifying unifier of the convention, and that is hatred for Donald Trump. But anyway, what caught me during her remarks, Michelle Obama, is how she was saying things with no sense of irony about how contradictory she sounded. First of all, she was referring to her parents and growing up and where she learned her appreciation of, you know, values and what's important in life, and her parents and how they felt about wealth and pursuing money and wealth.
She and my father didn't aspire to be wealthy. In fact, they were suspicious of folks who took more than they needed.
Okay, and then that line actually got applause. A couple of things. First of all, the Obamas, the only president not to leave Washington, D.C. after his presidency is Barack Obama. They have a beautiful home near Embassy Row in Washington, D.C. But they also have a place on the shore, a beautiful estate in Hawaii. Plus, they also have about a $20 million estate on Martha's Vineyard. So this is now a couple that is worth between $150 and $160 million. Being an ex-president pays pretty well. $150 to $160 million. And they're talking about people, about how her parents didn't like how people take more than they need. One more time here.
She and my father didn't aspire to be wealthy. In fact, they were suspicious of folks who took more than they needed.
But that's the second thing that caught my attention. What do you mean they took more than they needed? What does that mean? They took more. You mean they made more? They earned more? That's very revealing about how many liberals see money. That if you have a lot of money, you took it. You're taking more than you need. The idea that you're generating this money, that you've made this money, you've earned this money, gets replaced with you're taking more than you need. Classic Marxist view of wealth and freedom. The other thing she said that caught my attention was she was criticizing Donald Trump, but said something that I thought was incredibly revealing about her own party. Have a listen.
If things don't go our way, We don't have the luxury of whining or cheating others to get further ahead. No. We don't get to change the rules, so we always win.
Oh, well, who's going to win the Democratic nomination for president? Kamala Harris. How did that happen? Yeah, you do get to change the rules. You do get to change things, don't you? And by the way, who tried to change the rules to get Donald Trump thrown off the ballot? They actually succeeded in a couple of states before the U.S. Supreme Court essentially, in legalese, said knock it off. Had they ruled that voting was strictly a state issue, there were about 15 other states prepared to throw Donald Trump off the ballot. So, yeah, you do like to change the rules to make sure you win. Why isn't Joe Biden accepting the nomination this week? Many millions of people, Democrats, voted to make Joe Biden the Democratic nominee. How many people voted for Kamala Harris to make her the nominee? Zero. Nobody voted for Kamala Harris.
Well, just however many delegates there are. Was that maybe 400 or 500 something?
No, I'm talking about the primaries,
exactly,
the caucuses.
Right? Yeah.
Nobody
yeah.
voted for.
Yeah.
And then when we get to the convention, oh, it's a new story. Those delegates have been released because Joe Biden was putting the country ahead of his own ambitions. I love how Nancy Pelosi's not going along with the script, and she's continuing to say, I did what I had to do. Of course she did. Of course. The Democrats are incredibly disciplined and incredibly merciless. When they think someone is holding back the chances of maintaining or acquiring power, they will cut them loose. We've seen it happen to senators. We've seen it happen to members of the House. And man, oh man, for the first time in American history, we've seen it happen to a president. Joe Biden didn't want to leave the stage. Joe Biden is off the stage. The president didn't want to step away. He stepped away. So, yeah, actually, you guys do have do-overs. And you guys, you know, you just had a do-over for your entire nomination process. You just canceled out all the caucuses and all the primaries. And again, we're not talking about someone who tragically passed away and had the votes to secure the nomination. We're not talking about someone who, you know, say had a stroke and could no longer function. We are talking about someone who the Democrats were making excuses for up until the debate with Donald Trump. And then they said, you know, I don't think we're going to be able to pull this off. I don't think we're going to be able to keep him under wraps sufficiently and win this race. So we had to go. It is 14 minutes after 7 o'clock. Ladies and gentlemen, you know what happens on Wednesdays here on the John Carlson Show. Our legendary lyric competition is underway. The renowned, worldwide, world-famous, kind of, sort of, legendary lyric contest. I give you the lyric to a hit song, famous song, from the past, though. And when you hear us play that lyric going in or out of commercial break, be the 10th caller, identify the song or the artist, and You got some good prizes coming your way. Isn't that right, Mark Christopher?
Loving to Daniel's Broiler. Thank you, Daniel's Broiler. Big fans of the contest. So $50 certificate, any four of the locations. You'll win that. Go to danielsbroiler.com, have a look at the menu, maybe book something for a Christmas party. Online reservations in advance, also a big hit. And a hit as well for a prize. They will be at the White River Amphitheater, John.
Oh, yeah.
The Beach Boys, Friday, September. The Beach Boys.
Doobie Brothers!
Sorry. Yes. Michael McDonald will be there with Tommy Johnston.
Not the Beach Boys. They're too old.
Yeah.
The Doobie Brothers.
Pat Simmons will be there. John McPhee. Robert Cray Band as part of the tour. Steve Winwood and Robert Cray are going back and forth, but Robert Cray's got connections to the Northwest. So yeah. Two tickets. Doobies, Friday, September 6th with the Daniels. It's a great prize.
All right. So here is your legendary lyric. I'm not a present for your friends to open. This boy's too young to be singing the blues. One more time. I'm not a present for your friends to open. This boy's too young to be singing the blues. All right. When we come.
Well, yeah, when you hear that.
Be the 10th caller, 206-421-5757. That's 206-421-5757. And, of course, this is the 60th anniversary of the day the Beatles played Seattle, the Seattle Center Coliseum. And later on this hour, we're going to bring it home local. Seattle hits bottom. A fatal carjacking, not in the wee hours, but during daylight. The victim of the carjacking, an 80-year-old woman who apparently was either dragged or run over by her own car by the carjacker. Where did this happen? Madison Park. One of the most desirable places in Seattle, neighborhoods in Seattle. So, again, this might, hopefully, you wonder if Seattle's lost its sense of shock, of being aghast, of being prompted to furious action. But this incident should do it. And we've got the details of it. It's, again, just an awful, awful story. But it's what I have been telling you here on the commute now for the last several years, which is that crime has gotten, especially among the young, has gotten increasingly random and increasingly vicious. Congratulations, KVI listener Tom in Edmonds. Yes, he recognized that Elton John, Bernie Taupin classic, Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, from the album of the same name. That song, of course, as with all Elton John compositions, he writes the music, he composes the music. Bernie Taupin wrote the lyrics. And Bernie Taupin wrote the lyrics about the town that he grew up in. And he was referring to his childhood farm in Lincolnshire. And basically, Yellow Brick Road means, you know, stepping out and getting on a different path that you hope will take you to happiness. And sometimes you recognize that it's taking you there, and sometimes you realize it's not. It was one of Elton John's biggest hits. Got to number two for several weeks, but didn't quite get to number one because the Carpenters had a song called Top of the World. And then Charlie Rich snuck into first place.
Wow.
with the most beautiful girl in the world. Sure.
That's a challenging race right there for those three.
Anyway, it it came out in, it was recorded in the spring of 73, came out in late 73, along with another Elton John song late in 1973 called Step Into Christmas.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Which we still hear all over today. Okay, Philip J. Vandervoort III, what are you hearing in the social media world?
Let's start with a local story from one of the Fox 13 anchor reporters, the social media sweep sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort. Fox 13 anchor David Rose on social media, he kind of summarized and previewed a story that he apparently is going to devote more attention to later in the week. And he posted onboard video of a King County Metro bus. And this, he doesn't give this particular location, so I'm not sure where this happened, but it was an attack on a woman riding the bus. And he writes, teen suspects in King County drag an innocent woman off the bus before beating and robbing her. At least one of the teens was on electronic home monitoring at the time. I'll detail this case on Friday on his show, The Spotlight, and ask, when have we had enough with being soft on juvenile crime? And there have been no shortage of stories this year. We've talked about the statistics of more juveniles being involved in shootings and being the victims of shootings and being murder victims here in King County. And when I noticed this post about this surveillance camera video on board the Metro bus, and David Rose is describing that the teen suspects, and he doesn't say how many, he doesn't say if it's two, doesn't say if it's four or five or how many specifically they are. He does add that at least one of those teens was on electronic home monitoring at the time of this new attack.
You do something like that with an ankle bracelet,
but that is
violating.
Sadly, a theme that we've unfortunately had to keep revisiting so far this year about suspects released on home ankle electronic monitoring that didn't stay at home, that ended up getting arrested and suspected of other crimes. But this is another example where the woman is attacked, dragged off the bus, beaten and robbed. And my ongoing concern that so many of these crime and public safety problems, and women are the victims. Women are the targets of the attack.
Where are the
feminists? Criminals don't pick on someone their own size. The criminals are picking on someone who's vulnerable, someone that they think will be an easy mark, an easy target.
Sure.
And they're going after women. And you previewed this story here in the last segment. An 80-year-old woman in Madison Valley. This is an upscale part of Seattle near Lake Washington and the Arboretum. And an 80-year-old woman who's walking dogs either as a way to just stay active and stay fit and stay healthy as an 80-year-old or doing it for maybe extra money in retirement, I'm not sure. And she is carjacked and killed in Madison Valley yesterday in the middle of the day. It was 10 o'clock in the morning. And how many times are we going to go round and round again where women are attacked? This is a war on women that Democrats in Washington, Seattle, King County, the Olympia legislature, have perpetrated on women around here. It's a war on women because these criminals keep going after women, and women are the victims.
And where
and are, unfortunately, we keep electing Democrats to these important positions, and they make it worse and worse and worse on women.
Well, I thought that Democrats were the party of women. I thought the Democrats were the party looking out after women.
That's their lip service, but they don't deliver.
No, they are not. And you said something interesting about criminals, you know, why they always pick on vulnerable people like 80-year-old women, or in this case, a woman dragged off a bus,
riding the bus.
And beaten. That's not going to do much to encourage women to ride Metro Transit. But anyway, it's a very simple reason, Phil. Criminals are cowards. Criminals are cowards. We don't often think that because criminals are scary and criminals are violent. Yeah, they're both those things. They're also cowards. They go after what Phil calls easy marks. They go after people they feel they can overpower or intimidate. They're cowards. And I am tired of people indulging these bullies time after time after time. it's almost like they think that maybe the bullies will start to be nice to me now. That if the criminal justice system just keeps giving them electronic home monitoring. Remember the story we did about the guy who had cut off more than, he had cut off four of his ankle bracelets and they still would not send him to juvenile detention? Again, that just makes our judges and at times our lenient prosecutors, remember, they're the ones who came up with this new approach to juvenile justice. That came out of not the public defender's office. That came out of the prosecutor's office. Cool back there in Chi-Town?
I am. The weather's actually been really fantastic. Not too humid, not too hot. Perfect walk around in a suit weather.
Wow. That is nice. That is good to hear. All right. So you had an interview with a guy who was very famous as a TV actor and even more famous as a movie maker, Rob Reiner, famous liberal from California. I mean, like very hardwired into the circuitry of the political elite in California, Rob Reiner. And I want to start with a great reference you made from one of his first movies, Spinal Tap, the so-called rockumentary, where there was a guitar player, Nigel. He was interviewing, and he said, you know, how do you get the most from your performance? He says, well, look at these amplifiers. These are unlike any other amplifiers you can find because these go to 11.
And I know, you know, Mark's a drummer, I'm a drummer, Phil's a drummer. It made me nervous talking to Rob Reiner. I was worried I might just explode, spontaneously combust.
Just a small little globule there.
We've all seen
anyway,
that movie.
I made Rob Reiner laugh, and so my life's close to complete. But, yeah, I hope you enjoy the Spinal Tap reference.
Let's play this real quick. This is part of the 90-second interview that Zach had with Rob Reiner there at the Democratic Convention.
Can I ask you one quick question, Mr. Reiner?
Yeah, sure.
What do the Democrats have to do to turn it up to 11 tonight?
We've already turned it up to 11. I mean, with Kamala Harris and Tim Walz, if you were here last night, I mean, the applause. I mean, Hillary was incredible. The party has completely coalesced around Kamala and Tim Walz. And we are already at 11. Maybe we'll turn it up past.
What did you make of the Joe Biden sort of passing the torch to Kamala Harris last night?
Well, he did what any great statesman, any great leader, any great public service servant would do, which is he cares more about the people he serves than about himself. And so he'll go down. If we win this election, which I believe we will, he'll go down in history as.
Well, I don't know if he'll go down in history, but he definitely went down.
singularly as a person who saved American democracy.
Now, seeing some of the demonstrations outside of the convention hall and the difference of what's going on in here, what needs to happen on stage for people at home to kind of make a connection between the unity inside of this convention hall and what's going on outside?
Well, I think they are. I mean, you know, if you're inside the convention hall and you're here all day, it can seem like it's dragging on, but the people at home are seeing the main points that are being made, and those points are being very clearly connected. The choice couldn't be more stark, and you'll either choose, like you say, a criminal or a person who knows how to prosecute a criminal.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Like I say, I don't remember saying anything like that. I don't think Rob Reiner's in the same part of Chicago that I'm in. I don't think he understood what I was referencing. Clearly, he has not been in front of a TV screen because I don't believe those demonstrators were, quote, advocating for choosing criminals at all.
No.
They were criminals.
Yes, that's, well, and they are supporting a criminal regime, Hamas. And, you know, people should know that this is not a homegrown movement to support Palestinians. This is a radical movement to support Hamas and its bid to drive Jews out of Israel. That's what they say you need to do to bring about peace. So what has transpired this morning. It's still kind of early, 9:40 in the morning in Chicago.
Not much is going on right now. We've got the local CBS affiliate news station on above us in the press box, and Jeff Pogula of Northwest News Radio and I noticed that they were interviewing one of the arrested protesters, and in the Chiron it had said that they were from Seattle. They traveled from Seattle to be a part of the protest, and Lord willing, they'll stay here.
Shama Sawant, behave yourself.
Well, wait a second now. Due process should be involved.
Allegedly. Time for an ankle monitor.
Allegedly, they'll be stuck here in Chicago.
All right. But nothing like the violence that had been feared has broken out yet. I should point out, though, there are not, you know, hundreds, but many thousands of protesters. There are definitely more protesters than delegates to this convention. So they have kept the lid on so far due to very impressive security and police tactics. We'll see if that holds for the remaining 2 days of the convention. And we'll check in with you again next hour, Zach. All right?
Sounds good.
All right. Very good. That is Young Zach live from the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. He is being our eyes on the inside.
He's doing such a great job.
He really is. That was a good interview.
This is like the first time he's ever done this in his life. He started here as an intern for something totally away from radio.
Yeah, he did not go through communications or broadcasting or journalism or anything like that. He's just a natural.
Just hung around all of us and picked up the gig, and just I'm just blown away every time he does a report. He's not afraid to go up to celebrities and important people and get what we need to deliver to you, the listeners.
Yes. So I often take credit for his success, even though I have nothing to do with it.
His tutelage?
It's just Young Zach. My protege, Young Zach. I brought him right along. Anyway, it is 7:45 on the John Carlson Show. We're going to break early because when we come back, I want to talk about bringing it home local, that terrible, awful story out of Madison Park. This might be an all-time low of everything that has gone wrong in Seattle in the past dozen years. This might be an all-time low. 80-year-old woman killed in a carjacking in the Madison Valley area, upscale area of Seattle. She was either dragged or run over by the carjacker. She had a dog in the back seat of the car, and the dog was also taken to another location and killed. The suspect is at large. More on this right ahead as the Commute with Carlson continues. Talk Radio 570 KV. Very good. Seattle has been facing so many challenges, so many problems that are self-made problems. And they have refused to reverse policies that have created terrible consequences, particularly when it comes to crime. And the latest example of what happens when you don't start cracking down on crime is what happened to an 80-year-old woman killed in a carjacking in the Madison Valley area. She was identified as a dog walker. She walks dogs in her retirement, probably to make some spare change and also to stay busy. And now she is dead. Here's David Rose, Fox 13.
Seattle police say a dog walker in her 80s was carjacked, dragged, and then run over with her own car. Police say the suspect then drove away, leaving the Madison Valley neighborhood shattered.
According to Seattle police, she was killed by the still-at-large carjacker. Ryan Sims from Como reports on more details here.
As far as violent crimes go, even cops with years of experience are shocked by this one. An 80-year-old dog walker attacked and carjacked before being left to die in the middle of this street.
He didn't need to run her over. Like, he had already gotten the car. He backed up into her.
This carjacking happened directly in front of Laura Dinan's home. At the time of the attack, the victim was taking several dogs to a nearby park, including Susan Lindsay's dog.
Wonderful person, very terrific with dogs, terrific with kids, terrific with cats, sitting all the time.
Hours later, the victim's car was found abandoned nearby. One of the dogs was discovered dead in a trash can.
It's upsetting for the whole city. Lest happen right in front of your own house.
A savage, senseless crime leading to shock for so many people.
Como's Jeremy Harris spoke to a neighbor near that carjacking scene yesterday.
During the struggle, the woman was run over and died here. Some of the dogs she was caring for got loose.
I'm just so sorry.
It's left neighbors in disbelief.
It just goes part and parcel for the kind of anarchy we have in Seattle now.
Well, yeah. But instead of being dismayed and in disbelief, maybe it's time for some anger. Maybe it's time for some fury. Because this didn't need to happen. The woman who is dead is Ruth Dalton. She was the owner of Grandma's Critter Care. Again, she takes dogs out walking for people who are too busy. And she, as you heard, had several dogs in her vehicle during the carjacking. One of which was found dead in a trash can next to the abandoned vehicle. When police arrived on the scene, there was someone performing CPR on Mrs. Dalton in the middle of the street. They said that bystanders unsuccessfully tried to intervene when they saw someone attacking her. A bystander actually came by with a baseball bat and tried to help, but before that could happen, the attacker backed over the body of Mrs. Dalton, which he had already dragged, and sped away. Some of the dogs in the vehicle escaped. Others were still in the car as it drove off. Seattle Department crews were unable to rescue her. Again, this is absolutely outrageous. Madison Park area of Seattle. And again, this was in the middle of the day. This is how bad it's gotten in the city of Seattle. Hour number three of the commute, right around the corner. Hour number three of the John Carlson Show, Wednesday, August 21st edition of the radio program of record, right where you need to be. Thank you very much letting me be part of your day, as I am every day of the work week from 6 to 9 a.m. If you can't get us on the air, clearly your reception starts to fade, not a problem. Listen to us live at KVI.com. Just go to KVI.com and click the button that says Listen Live, big yellow button, and perfect reception.
Did that once on the beaches of Oahu. It was really strange, but like, hey, I still can hear what's going on at home.
All over the world, perfect reception at KVI.com. And, of course, Philip J. Vandenberg III also loads up our content by noon. So if you, let's say, miss the first hour and say, oh, I wish I had caught that, you could catch it later on at your leisure whenever you want to listen to it.
And if you're sort of new to the whole kind of podcasting, time shifting sort of a thing, I didn't realize this until just a couple of months ago. If you do check out that hour and a half, 90 to 100 minute summary of your show, or the what we call the podcast of your show.
With no
ads.
You
can play it. You can play it at 1.5 times speed, so you can cut the time and a half that it takes you to listen to it, and then you can get to other things. So you can kind of compress time. Just when you click on the play button, look around. I think there's a settings function, or there's another indication of how you can increase the speed, and then you can get all the info in a shorter amount of time, and you can get on to other things that you want to do as well. But that's another function of some of the podcast access capabilities, and we're not the only ones that do this, but then you can consume more content in a shorter amount of time.
Plus, you get to, when you play my show at 1.5 times its normal speed, get to see how I sounded when I was 13 years old.
I was going to say, you don't sound like a chipmunk, but it does kind of make things go a little faster and kind of gives you back more of your time to do other things that you need in your life.
All right. Radio legend Mark Christopher, mm-hmm. This is the 60th anniversary. You were reminding me, the 60th anniversary of the Beatles playing the Edgewater.
This would be a nice little break here because we've had so much heavy-duty news, especially that last story. That's so disturbing up in Madison Valley. So just to breathe a little bit, everybody, I was going through some things yesterday, John, when you were gone, and Phil saying, Mark, we're on for John. Let's get some things together. And I found across a file or two I had about the Beatles in Seattle. Now, realizing all my years of radio music, John and Phil and everybody, people have come to me over the years saying, Mark, you know, things are getting older. If there's somebody that can do right with these kinds of things we have, per se, like the Beatles and their first visit to Seattle in 64, it's you. Plus, I've shared this, perhaps you never knew. As I was studying for radio and getting in gear and some of my first jobs, I worked at the Edgewater Hotel where the Beatles stayed in 1964. I was there about 10 years later. Suite 272, the Beatles suite, was there. How many people would say, hey, kid, you look kind of young, but can you get us into the suite? I never charged, but boy, did they tip. And there's just some things that have come across here over the years that a lot of you have asked about, just how crazy was it? And I shared with John and Phil early this morning. We are now in our new studios at KVI. Phil, you say about a year and a half now we've been here at the Gem building.
Yep, it's like February 2023 when we moved in.
Right, and we're about two blocks west of Climate Pledge Arena. Can you imagine 60 years ago right now if we were sitting here and all that was going on? The Beatles came to Seattle. This was their third of the many cities they did in that first tour. Now, first thing I just want to play real quick. I never met the Beatles, but better than that, two people in my life I cherish. Ken Mansfield, he was the Capitol Records rep for the Beatles and the Beach Boys all through the 60s. He's the guy you see, the only American, in the rooftop footage of the Beatles. And then there was one Larry Kane, not to be confused with King. He was a reporter in Florida at the time, could not even get into the Beatles. But talk about a job of a lifetime. Brian Epstein worked with U.S. officials saying, wouldn't it be easier if we had our own reporter to go with us during the entire tour to work with local media and get those interviews we can never get from others? Here's a little bit of what he had here in Seattle.
We're out here in front of the Edgewater Inn Hotel on Elliott Bay. And listen to this.
I've been traveling with them all across the country, and this is one of the wildest receptions we've received.
It is.
Are you proud of it?
Yeah!
Who's your favorite Beatle?
Paul.
Why?
He's the cutest.
And who's your favorite?
Paul.
And your favorite?
Ringo.
Are you getting tired?
Oh, yeah, but I can't help it. I'm tired. I just want him.
Well, we got a mixed-up crowd here today anyhow. You got beautiful weather up here in Seattle. How many people are expected to be at the concert tonight?
14,000.
Yeah, and this would change the whole venue of putting concerts into theaters, John, and the Armory, if you remember, the Coliseum would be a packed place. Now, over the years, I talked to sound crew engineers who have worked for me. What was it like to be there in 64? They said, Mark, we were not prepared. What we were told is the entire sound system was equivalent to what you'd have maybe at a wedding in a church hall for about 100 people. In a moment, I'm going to play you actually the only time you could hear the Beatles on the stage at the Coliseum. Quick story from the Edgewater. A lot of people have asked, did they ever get in the fans? Yes, they did. But the greatest story
did
I learned.
Get what?
Did fans ever get into the Edgewater Hotel while we're here? Now, it's true. The Edgewater was the only hotel during the 64 tour that was not trashed by all the fans. You've seen video, perhaps, a chain link fence, the plywood, police all around. Some people tried to go by boat, but we had patrol boats out there. above the Beatles and Suite 272, the famous picture, they're fishing out the window. Okay, that was just publicity. They were never baited hooks to catch fish. A great story I heard, 11-year-old Sandy Fleesbach was in town with her family. They were attending a wedding. They were directly above the Beatles on the third floor. She saw the commotion down below. She had a fishing rod, which you could pick up from the gift shop. She lowered the line with a note attached to the hook. Can I get autographs? Moments later, she reeled it up. John, Paul, George, and Ringo with the actual autographs. All right, Seattle Center Coliseum. We had that PA system that was just, you couldn't hear it. In fact, at one point, Pat O'Day told me, who was the host, longtime legend radio announcer, said, Mark, at one point, George Harrison unplugged his guitar from the amplifier. And Pat said, what are you doing? He said, they can't even hear me. After the first four songs, there was a new song the Beatles had out. Most people didn't hear it. What happens when you see a band doing a new song? You're like, okay, let's just kind of listen and be quiet a little bit. The song was The Things We Say Today, but this, as I warn you, you may want to turn up your radio. This was the quieter time of the 10-to-1 ratio girls to boys at the Coliseum this day in 1964 in Seattle. Before they get to maybe an energetic part of the song, I will warn you, because your radio is going to get loud, and that energy you hear at that point stayed on for the rest of the concert. Okay, listen. Okay, here comes the energy. Here we go. I'm told this is about 10 rows back from the stage, and you couldn't even hear this. The concert was only 30 minutes. It was 12 songs. Righteous Brothers were on the bill. People said, well, I bought a ticket, paid $5 to see the Righteous Brothers. This was a year before You've Lost That Loving Feeling, so they were still up and coming. And then we had the Bill Black combo. They were from Memphis, Tennessee, calling themselves kind of like the hillbillies of rock and roll. And then we also had Jackie DeShannon there as well. But that's what it was like 60 years ago.
That is wild. That's wild. Great report taking us back in time to a much more innocent era. Again, that was 60 years ago today. This was their first tour.
Yeah.
And Seattle made their first tour, and they were at the Edgewater.
Third city. Two years after the World's Fair, we were worried, what are we going to do with the Coliseum? It's so big. I mean, can we do something with it? And this kind of opened the whole door, and we know
what I can't get followed. Over is they had dozens of hits by then.
Yeah.
Why on earth did they play only 12 songs?
They get tired.
And you said they had the equivalent of a sound system you'd see in if you rented out a church basement for a wedding.
Put it this way, you know those little, well, I say little, the disco guys and gals we hire now to do and their sound systems, those are louder than what we had at the Coliseum 60 years ago today.
Oh,
so you couldn't hear it. That's why. And the Screaming Girls 10-to-1, 14,000.
I had heard, and I don't even know if it's true.
Yeah.
So I haven't, broadcast it as such, that when they played the first stadium show, the first rock and roll act to play a stadium, a Shea Stadium in New York, that basically they ran the concert through the stadium PR, public announce.
Oh, that helps.
PA
yeah.
system.
Yeah.
That was the sound system they used.
Yeah. And closest I came to meeting Beatles, I was there when Wings Over America hit the Kingdom, June of 76. Paul McCartney, he had to come back to the Edgewater, okay? 30 rooms he had at the Edgewater. He brought his kids. I couldn't make the concert. I was working room service in and out of some of those rooms. His kids were the best, well-behaved children I have ever seen in a fancy hotel like the Edgewater.
How about that?
Yeah, there you go.
Not surprised. All right, back we go to the convention. We played you some of the remarks of Michelle Obama, including this gem about do-overs.
If things don't go our way, we don't have the luxury of whining or cheating others to get further ahead. No. We don't get to change the rules, so we always win.
Joe Biden might have a thing or two to say about changing rules. This is the first time in American history that a candidate for president had secured the votes for nomination and did not receive the nomination. Not because he was dead, not because he had suffered, you know, a stroke, not because he was in a scandal, but because Democrat power brokers had simply concluded, correctly, in my view, he was going to lose. Said, well, if he's going to lose, who cares if he's earned the nomination? Who cares about these 16 million votes that he has received in all these primaries and caucuses? Who cares if he's got the delegates? Get him off the ballot. And in a remarkably short period of time, the same people who, frankly, were covering for him and making excuses for him up until his debate with Donald Trump, up until late June, they all of a sudden went from covering for him to saying, no, it ain't going to work. This isn't going to work. We got to get rid of him. And he was pushed aside. He's clearly still doesn't want it. And his or still is upset and angry about this. His wife, Jill Biden, PhD, spoke at the convention. And here is her spin.
And weeks ago, when I saw him dig deep into his soul and decide to no longer seek re-election and endorse Kamala Harris.
Yeah. He did it after soul searching. That's what he did. You know, I've been thinking. I've just been reflecting on my life, my career. I think I'm going to hand the nomination over to the vice president and just skip this election. Does anyone really believe that happened? And this whole thing about, you know, as we heard Young Zach's interview with Rob Reiner echoing what almost every Democratic politician has said, that he put his country first and his own ambition aside. Are you kidding? He was dragged, grasping onto the Resolute desk. This isn't the product of soul searching. It was made very clear to him. You're not going to be our nominee because you're going to lose. And if you leave now, you can be a hero. And we'll say you're a latter-day George Washington, someone who walked away from power. And if not, then, well, then it's going to get ugly. And people, very prominent public people, are going to break with you, and they're going to say why. And you know why. You can't win, and that's really all that matters. You know, your debate against Donald Trump made it clear the strategy you had about being able to, you know, quietly push ahead and get inaugurated for a second term and then hang on for a while and then, you know, whatever happens, happens. It ain't going to happen. So, yeah, you just have to shake your head at their audacity that they think they can get away with this. They think they can get away with this. Therefore, they think they can get away with remaking Kamala Harris. Kamala Harris, 2 months ago, was seen as a drag on the presidential ticket. Repeat, Biden was okay, but Kamala was a drag on the ticket.
They might have substituted her out, right?
And you know, we're
for
talking
another running mate.
Yeah, we're talking. Yes, but they weren't going to because, as a black woman, they would have been stirring up a hornet's nest of racial backlash and gender backlash if they tried to push her out. And so that was never seriously considered by serious people. But it was more or less acknowledged that she did not bring strength to the ticket for re-election. And yet now they're trying to say, for heaven's sakes, here she is. The torch has been passed to a new generation. She is ready. She is prepared. She is experienced. Oh, my goodness. No, she isn't. She's experienced in failing. She's experienced. What has she done that's successful in this administration? Other than casting a couple of tie-breaking votes, which is what you do when you're vice president, other than casting a couple of tie-breaking votes that arguably created much of the inflation that has wrecked the economy for so many people, what has she actually done? Her major responsibility that she was given, assignment, portfolio, the border, she completely screwed up and made it not only dramatically worse, she made it historically dramatically worse. And yet, look at the pageantry, look at the coronation, look at the choreography. It will continue tonight with her running mate, Tim Walz, who is going to be bringing that ticket nothing but grief in the weeks ahead, for reasons we have already told you. The rest of the country will be catching up soon. Philip J. will be catching up with the social media sweep, his favorite segment of the day, social media from socialists right around the corner. It's 8:21. Good morning.
I had no idea that Van Halen had, it's a concert performance, so it's not a studio or a Norwegian album performance.
Wood. Norwegian
Wood. Van Halen.
That's not the song you think they'd be playing.
No kidding.
Norwegian Wood. Rubber Soul.
That's a new one for me. So socialists on social media?
I know why that didn't appear on an album.
Maybe it didn't get a lot of widespread attention.
I know why they didn't want to have widespread distribution of this song. Yikes.
I'm guessing that must have been the Sammy Hagar of Van Halen talking and not the Eddie or Alex of Van Halen talking.
All right. Philip J., social media from socialists. There's a lot of stuff out there today.
Man, you know, you had these tone-deaf comments from Michelle Obama at the convention last night in Chicago, and I've got a tone-deaf tweet from the Washington Democrats and the social media sweep sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort. And this one revolves around electric vehicles. So here's what the Washington Democrats posted earlier this week on social media. They posted, "We have a choice, move forward or go backwards. Here in Washington, we're making progress and bringing everyone along. Now working families can afford electric vehicles and spend a lot less at the gas pump." And it's just brutally ironic that Democrats like the legislature, House and Senate majorities and legislature, Governor Inslee passed the Climate Commitment Act and this cap and tax invest carbon pricing scheme that has increased the price of gasoline. And then in turn, the Democrats turn around and go, hey, look at how generous these rebates are if you buy an electric vehicle. And so the Washington Democrats story is pointing to they're linking a crosscut.com story that says Washington rolls out one of the nation's most generous EV rebate programs. So tax breaks, but only if you want to buy an electric vehicle. And if they hadn't have made gasoline prices so expensive in the first place, they wouldn't come anywhere close to somebody deciding, you know what, maybe I should go and spend extra money out of my own pocket to buy the electric vehicle.
So I tell you what. Let's subject this to the Inslee test. Inslee said that he wanted a dramatic increase in people buying EVs, electric vehicles.
Right. They have targets that they're supposed to meet, don't they?
Well, that's what I'm getting to. Yeah. They have specific targets to underscore his commitment and determination. How close is he getting to his targets?
My guess is not close at all.
Well, we've had Todd Myers on the show. They're not even in the ballpark. So now they're trying to, A, increase the price of gas, which they've done through the Climate Commitment Act and its carbon tax. And that's what Initiative 2117 is going to give you the chance to repeal that artificial tax on gasoline. and then have this huge rebate program among the most generous of any state in the country. They're still not making it. They're still not coming close. So even when they try and rig the game, they still lose the game. It is coming up here on 8:30, The Commute with Carlson, Talk Radio 570 KVI. You got one more, Phil?
No, because I want to hear Zach's conversation and interview with the Florida Congressman Byron Donalds.
Yeah.
Which is coming up
next.
It's
coming right up here on The Commute. Byron Donalds, a Republican, black Republican congressman from Florida, decided to sojourn to Chicago. And Zach was able to get a few minutes with him. And you want to hear this conversation. It's really good stuff. And it's coming right up here on The Commute with Carlson, as we are following with live coverage what's going on at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, both in the convention hall and also outside, as more and more protesters are descending upon the Windy City. All right, you got 24 minutes and 9 o'clock on the John Carlson Show. And we continue our live coverage from the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. Our eyes on the inside. Young Zach here from our staff is back there. Zach, how are you?
I'm doing well, John. Thanks for playing that little bit of horn section there, Mark. Speaking of saxophone, we got Bill Clinton speaking later tonight. I brushed paths with him down in the hallway Monday night. So we'll see what he's got to say later, see if we can keep it on schedule, which I doubt.
Well, all I can say is if you were an attractive blonde woman, he would have given you much more attention.
But, I don't know how to take that, but I was happy to be ignored. I'll leave it at that.
Okay. You had a wonderful conversation. Congressman Byron Donalds, a black Republican from the state of Florida, decided to head to Chicago and let people know, hey, there's another side to the story. And which is kind of gutsy, walking into, if you will, the lion's den. He was not reluctant. And young Zach was able to snag a few minutes with him. Here, have a listen.
Congressman, this is a unique interview. You're a familiar face to our listeners. We're a conservative talk station out of Seattle.
Yeah.
You're not a familiar face around here. How's your experience been so far here at the DNC?
I wouldn't say that. I think a lot of people becoming familiar with my face. But in it's not really about that. I think... Look, you know, the Democrats, this is their convention, and they, you know, want to be able to put on a good show and lay out their vision for America. I mean, I personally believe there's not much of a vision, but that's my viewpoint. I think what's really important is our country being able to get on track for some of these wounds, these old political wounds, to kind of heal and find ways where we can move forward together as one country. I think that's the thing that's bigger than anything else. So, you know, being here has been good. You know, people kind of see me and they're like, oh, shoot, is that him for real? And I'm like, yeah, it's me. And, you know, you just move on. But, you know, I'm comfortable in any atmosphere. I'm a city kid from Brooklyn, New York. So you just have to learn how to be able to move and operate in any situation.
I'm a young man. I came in here, you know, I thought I work for a conservative station, but I came with an open mind. I want to hear what policies these guys are gonna put out there on stage.
Right.
I didn't hear many last night. Was I missing something?
No,
I didn't hear a plan.
No, there were no policies last night. And, I mean, look, like I said over there, it's tough for Kamala Harris and Tim Walz because she's a part of the current administration. As much as she doesn't want to talk about it, she is. Every decision that was made, she was right there for it. She was a tie-breaking vote in the Senate for so many of them. So how does she run away from the current state of public policy in America when she's a sitting vice president? You really can't. So in that environment, what do you do? Is she going to just throw all of the Joe Biden policies under the bus the way they threw Joe Biden under the bus? No, that's not going to work. I think that would upset the progressive left. They wouldn't be happy with that. So she's going to take the Joe Biden policies, take them further to the left, and see what happens. And I think that's why everything's much more focused on joy and vibes as opposed to inflation and border security.
Now, let's say they gave you a spot up on that stage tonight, and I got about the next best thing. I got a whole Seattle listening base out there. That's almost the same as the nation's Democrats out there in that arena. What would you say to them?
Well, I mean, first of all, if you put the microphone in my hand out there, you know, we'll wade through some of the initial reaction. There'll be an initial reaction, make no mistake about that. But I think we do have a uniting message on the Republican side of the aisle, because whether you're, you know, white or black or Republican, Democrat, you know, everybody wants lower costs for food and for the important things in life and for housing. Everybody wants a thriving and growing economy. I think everybody does want secure borders. Most people want secure borders. We do want to have a legal process where people can come into our country and become a part of the fabric of America. And nobody wants to be engaged in endless wars and unnecessary conflicts around the globe. If a conflict comes to America, I'm quite sure the spirit of our country will be prepared to meet that challenge. But we don't want to be in unnecessary conflicts either. And that's where leadership comes into play. And I think those are things that unite our country, regardless of some of the divisions that we have.
And last question, Congressman. Certainly we've witnessed a lot of this out here in Chicago with the civil unrest, shall we say, outside the convention hall last night, all regarding what's going on in Gaza and Israel. What do you think the Democrats need to do tonight or in the rest of the convention here to have some sort of unifying message on at least that one issue?
Look, to be blunt, I don't think they really have an ability to unify themselves. There's a very stark divide in the Democrat Party around our relationship with Israel. It's a very stark difference. And so it's going to be very difficult for them to cure that. I don't know how they do it. I think the way you do it is you stand by Israel. They are our ally. They have stood with us through thick and thin, and we need to do the same.
Congressman, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for being a part of the KVI insurgency.
All right, take it easy, man.
Very good conversation. Great questions.
Thank you. Yeah, what a class act. That guy had been doing media all day long, his press aide was telling me. And he said, "But let me explain what you guys are doing, and let's see if we can get him on." And he liked what we were doing, liked the kind of undercover coverage we had, and was nice enough to take time out of his schedule and time out of being swarmed by the opposition to talk to the KVI audience out in Seattle. So once again, thank you to Congressman Byron Donalds for taking the time with us.
Yes. Well, we'll remember that, you know. you know, they believe that over 70 people were arrested last night.
Wow.
According to the Radical National Lawyers Guild, let's put it this way. The National Lawyers Guild thinks that the ACLU are too conservative. They also have longstanding ties to the Communist Party. So these are people who want to be lawyers so they can literally push communism. I mean, that's how far out there they are. They say at least 72 individuals were arrested and taken to the 19th Police District Precinct. They said that you know, they use shields, batons, other riot gear to try and maintain a barrier. But when there were violent clashes and they were able to wrestle these people down and arrest them, they did. So this is the second day of, we'll call it unrest and wannabe rioting. We'll see if it continues this evening. Whether the protests gain momentum or whether they run out of gas. Now, there were protests in Milwaukee at the Republican convention. Like Chicago, they were outside the perimeter, which is sealed with a fence, as was the case in Milwaukee at the Republican convention and the Democratic convention. But after a couple of days, they fizzled. I think I saw like 50 or 60 people at one of their protest rallies on either Wednesday or Thursday. Everyone was going home.
Well, and if you recall from when we were kind of covering some of the demonstrations back at the RNC, Jonathan Cho's video and what we were seeing, there was no unifying protest. That was not an organized cause. It was just a group of people there to protest for the sake of protesting. They were chanting different things, all having signs and supporting different causes. It was far from an organized protest.
Yeah. But these are very organized, and there have been outbreaks of violence And again, over 70 arrests made last night. We'll see if that trend continues or not. Got to ask you one more quick question. Who has been your favorite speaker so far at the convention?
I'd have to certainly say Senator Raphael Warnock. That was a very powerful speech. He had the entire place on their feet and really a captivating speaker, which is no surprise. We've all known that. But he had the best speech so far. And the one observation I took away from last night's lineup, when Michelle Obama walked out on stage, clearly that was who this crowd wanted to see as their nominee. It was the most energy I'd seen from this crowd thus far. I'm interested tomorrow to compare her entrance with Kamala Harris's entrance, because I really don't think it's going to compare.
Well, I think Kamala Harris, people will be on their feet. People will be chanting.
Oh, certainly.
People will be cheering, excited. People will be stomping their feet and everything. But will you feel, that's a very good point young Zach here is making. Will you feel the same sense of energy and passion that the room convulsed in when Michelle Obama walked out?
I was trying to make my way down to the floor last night during her speech, trying to get some pictures, get some audio, and staff of the arena were just trying to poke their heads through the door just to get a glimpse. I mean, the place was just mesmerized when she walked out, and I really don't think that's going to be challenged. I just don't think it's possible from what we saw last night, but we will see. I did put one picture up on the KVI Twitter. I want to direct people to at KVI Seattle on X, rather. I took a picture after the convention hall had cleared out last night, and it is pretty telling. I noticed this when I was walking around on the floor, and I was it's very dirty. All the signs, all the placards, all those. Last night they said vote. On Monday night they said we love Joe. All those stick things that they had up in the air. The convention floor is trashed. I mean, my post was that they leave their convention floor like they leave their city streets, covered in crap. I mean, it is littered is an understatement with how what a disaster it was down on the floor. And I just thought that was interesting from, the party that would prefer to recycle and clean up, one would think. So,
well, you were at the Republican convention. Do a side-by-side comparison.
I never saw anything like that. Not to say that there wasn't some stuff on the ground here or there, but I never saw anything like this.
Young Zach at the Republican National Convention last month and at the Democratic National Convention right now through the rest of the convention's proceedings through Thursday. Looking forward to more of your reports, Zach. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
It is, well, here's a song about the last Democratic convention that didn't go so well, and, well, not last, but the one in 68. Won't you please come to Chicago for a ride? 48 minutes after 8 o'clock. Good having you here on The Commute with Carlson Talk Radio 570 KVI. By the way, I've got a couple of her comments, Michelle Obama's, which probably show that she doesn't always think through what she's saying. You'll hear what I'm talking about coming right up. Good to have you on the John Carlson Show. Here's a couple things Michelle Obama said yesterday. Talk about not being self-aware. She's talking about how her parents felt about wealth.
She and my father didn't aspire to be wealthy. In fact, they were suspicious of folks who took more than they needed.
Okay, that's interesting how she characterizes that. They took more than they needed. So if you earned a lot of money, are you taking more than you need, or are you earning money? Taking more, that's more or less a Marxist outlook. But beyond that, what are you kidding me, Michelle Obama? You and your husband are worth between $150 and $160 million. I guess being an ex-president and first lady pays pretty well these days. $150 million. You own three mansions, one in Hawaii on the water, one in Martha's Vineyard on the water, one in D.C. And you're talking about that? And then you have this about do-overs?
Go our way, We don't have the luxury of whining or cheating others to get further ahead. No. We don't get to change the rules, so we always win.
I think that that is exactly what happened to Joe Biden. You changed things around so you could win the Democratic nomination for Kamala Harris. All right, let's talk again tomorrow. Have a great rest of the day.